This is Mintcast, a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. We record every other week on Sunday afternoons. Watch the Mintcast website for the schedule. Livestream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. We're in the Mintcast channel in IRC at irc.spotchat.org. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Post at reddit.com/r/mintcast or post directly at mintcast.org. And now, here's the show. So welcome to Mintcast episode 299. I am Leo, and with me today is Bo.
Hey, Leo, how's it going?
It's going well. And Tony Hughes.
Hi, guys.
And Tony Watts.
Hey, gang.
And Joe.
Hello.
Moss isn't feeling too good today, so we'll be running the show without him today. So this week we've got a long list of biweekly wonderings. Actually, I think we kind of cut that down now that Moss isn't going to be here, so it may be pretty quick. And we'll just roll right into them. So up at the top, I've been dealing with a fresh install of Linux Mint 19.1, which has been going pretty well for me, except for my Wine staging. So in the pre-show yesterday, we were talking about gaming and Wine and Proton and all that other kind of fun stuff. And what I had run into over the past week or so was when I tried to install Wine staging, it kept giving me weird issues. Let me see. I have it written down. And it says, Wine HQ-staging depends on Wine-staging. And I was like, that's kind of weird. That usually is just what pulls in whenever you install Wine HQ staging. So I kind of just ran down that rabbit hole and installed Wine-staging. And then it said it depends on Wine-staging-i386. I was like, okay, I'll do that now. So I installed that. It pulled in all the 32-bit dependencies and then went back and installed WineHQ-staging, and it seemed to work just fine. So there was some kind of weirdness going on there. And this is on two different installs. I tried Cinnamon and Mate, and it happened on both. So I suspect it may have happened on Ubuntu as well, because it wasn't anything special to Linux Mint, so it was weird. And this morning, I updated everything, and I got an error on the WineHQ repository saying that its code name changed from nothing to Bionic. So I think maybe that may be the issue. So I'm going to try fresh install and try installing it again and see what happens.
Reinstall in the first place? Why did you need a fresh install of Linux Mint?
Mostly because I'm afraid of upgrades. I blamed that on Windows last time, but honestly, the Mint update would probably work just fine. And the other thing I was doing is also something we talked about yesterday was making wallpapers. There's a really cool website. If you haven't checked it out yet, it's linux.pictures, and it's got a huge amount of really cool Linux-based art or Unix-based art. And they've got someone had written a script for that website to take any of those pictures, because they're all like they're all taller than they are wide, so they don't work really well for widescreen anything. And there's a script that will take all those pictures and add a matching color to the empty space to make it widescreen. So, yeah, that's what I've been dealing with, some weird Linux Wine issues and then just making tons and tons of wallpapers. And Joe's been dealing with some gaming stuff here, too. How about you, Joe? What have you been doing?
Well, I've been playing Watch Dogs. Mostly trying to get it set up in Linux, but that hasn't worked for me. Something about Uplay on Linux just doesn't want to work. I mean, I tried Proton, I tried Lutris, and it simply doesn't want to work. So I have had to get my dual boot machine up on the Windows side, and I was playing it there. But it is a really fun game. There was a lot of hype behind it when it first came out, and I don't know if it quite meets that, but I am enjoying the game. Now, I did also update all my tablets, all three of them, to 19.1. Really smooth, really easy install. Haven't noticed much of a difference, and they're working fine. So 19.1 is good to go on them. I was, until partway through last week, using SSHFS and VPN to my home server. It was working really well. I was able to access all my files. It was like they were all local, probably because of my really good upload speed on my server. But I did, I pulled a derp, and I did an update on my server and a restart from 700 miles away, and it didn't come back. So I had to switch up what I was doing, and I've been watching a lot of Linus Tech Tips, and he does a lot of building gaming machines, building low-cost gaming machines, and reviewing of, like, insanely expensive machines just to see what they will and won't do. He works mostly with Windows because, you know, gaming and Windows, but it's still a good watch. So if you get a chance, check out Linus Tech Tips.
Yeah,
and that's really all I've been doing. Yeah,
Linus Tech Tips, they have a section of videos where they have like a challenge to build a PC, you know, without using
stuff.
Yeah, that is so amazing. I sat down and watched hours of that one day because I just discovered it. I didn't even know it was a thing, and I just back to back watched episodes. It's genius content.
Yeah, I've been loving Scrapyard Wars.
So is that just Frankenstein and computers together?
Yeah, they will. Well, one of the seasons, they were not allowed to use the internet to find parts. So they had to drive around and talk to different shops to find parts and build a reasonable gaming machine. And another time, they had to do it with very little money, but they did have access to the internet. So, like a $500 gaming machine, it's two teams, and whoever gets the higher benchmarks wins.
Yeah, they do.
That
benchmark.
Sounds pretty awesome.
I saw one episode where they actually bought a plane ticket and flew somewhere, and they did that on their own money. It wasn't part of the budget, so that they could get some part in, like,
well,
Phoenix
they were talking.
Or
something. Yeah, it was in California, and they were talking about buying the ticket to do it, but then they decided to go with a local shop.
Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy show. So it sucks that you're having to play Watch Dogs on Windows, but at least you could use this opportunity to try out the Steam streaming feature. If you have like a Linux laptop or something, you could stream Watch Dogs from your Windows desktop to the laptop.
Yeah, well, I usually do that if I'm playing in my garage because I got a little set-top box out there that's not really powerful enough to run any of the games, but it is powerful enough to stream, usually Borderlands 2. So that'll be running on my gaming laptop, and I'll be out in the garage using my set-top box.
That's pretty cool, man.
How far did you get on Uplay installation in Linux?
Well, with Lutris, not very far. Lutris, I had it set up, and it was showing that Watch Dogs was downloading, but it ended up running at like 60 kbps, and when you're trying to download 20 some odd gigs worth of game, it's going to take a while. But I restarted the download a couple of times, and eventually the slowness went away and it downloaded, and then it would pop up saying that it was loading Uplay, and then it would die.
Ow. Okay.
Error, no anything. It would... One time, it would close out just the Uplay portion, and you'd still be able to see Steam in the background. And then the next time, I would try to run it again, and it would completely close out Steam as well. So, I'm not sure what's wrong there. I'm still looking for where I can find the logs and try and diagnose the problem. But I haven't seen it yet.
Interesting.
Now, running it from Proton... It did pop up the Uplay screen, but it would not get to the login portion. It would just sit there and say, I think, connecting or something like that, or updating, and it would just be stuck there, and nothing would ever happen.
That almost makes me wish I had Watch Dogs so I could try this puzzle out.
Well, anything that has Uplay would still have the same issues, so I don't... know what else you could get that would have the Uplay, but I know Watch Dogs and Watch Dogs 2 both have it, and it was Watch Dogs 2 that I was trying to run.
Got it. I'll have to dig through my library, see if I have any Ubisoft games.
You can probably just install Uplay itself, right? Like, it's probably just something you can download without having to buy any of the games.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I think it's like Steam or whatever.
Yeah, and I bet if we get Uplay to work, then I think we could get the game to work. At least, you know, it seems like you're stuck on that step anyway.
Right. And I think Lutris has their own download site where you can download specific scripts for specific games. So I'll definitely check it out and see if they have Uplay.
Yeah, that's how I do all the Battle.net stuff, and they all work pretty well.
Okay.
And Tony Watts, you've got some upgrade news for us as well, huh?
Yeah, I upgraded my podcasting machine to 19.1. I think I actually did it just before we talked a couple weeks ago and just hadn't rebooted it yet. But since then I have, and everything's good. It's hardly noticeable. Everything's working fine.
Now, did you follow the instructions on the Linux Mint blog, or how did you do the upgrade?
It's been a couple weeks now, so I'm trying to remember, but I think I just went into the update manager and just kind of poked around in there and saw where to do it, and it installed and rebooted. The whole thing took maybe 10 minutes.
Not bad.
Yeah, it went pretty well. The other things I've been messing with while I'm off work, I'm trying to do a hard drive clone for my Windows machine. And really, it's kind of just as a learning exercise. Otherwise, I would have been inclined to just do a fresh install onto this SSD. But I'm trying to do the cloning, and I was trying to do it with Gparted. I had heard that you can just copy-paste partitions from drive to drive, and that works well. I'm still fighting with it. So suggestions are welcome, but I was trying to do it with Gparted, but I'm not married to that.
Yeah, I've tried doing that. It's been years now, though. I don't know if anything's changed since then, but I didn't have any luck with it myself.
How's your DD skills?
I could do that. I'm trying to do this on a Ubuntu startup USB, so that might be the easiest thing, really. I don't want to have to go and try to install software.
Yeah, it just takes forever to do it with DD.
Yeah, and there's no progress bar, so you just sit there. You just sat there scratching your head, hoping it works.
A progress bar. I don't remember it, but I know that there is a way to get a progress bar now.
Yeah, you had to set up a whole lot of stuff on it. There was a website I was looking at that had something to that effect, and I was like, let me just DD my thing.
I'll probably do that. There really isn't any reason. I mean, I could have just backed up the files and did a clean install onto the new drive, and that would have been by far the easiest thing, and I knew that, but what do you learn if you do that?
Yeah, right, exactly.
The other thing I was playing... Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd never heard that Gparted could actually do cloning of drives. I'll have to have a look at that, because if it's fairly easy to do, it might make life a bit simpler.
That's what I was hoping for.
Yeah, I think the trick with it is that you have to have identical hardware.
That might make sense. I'm copying, it's a bigger spinning drive to a smaller SSD, and I was trying to just copy the partition. And what it looked like is the first time I did it, the flags didn't copy over properly. And then I'm running into some other issues with errors about readability of the NTFS Windows partition and stuff, trying to copy it the second time. So I don't know. I may yet get that to work. It looks like in theory it should, but I went through one unsuccessful attempt so far.
And I'd also check if in your FS tab file whether or not the discard option gets added on if you're successful doing the copy, because coming from a mechanical drive going to SSD, I'm not positive that I know Linux will detect it, but I don't know that Linux will then go in and edit the FS tab file after the fact. So keep an eye out for that.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I was having a bit more fun with than drive cloning. I was goofing around with the Pi Zero and RetroPie and got some stuff to work that was pretty fun. I don't know if you guys remember a couple weeks back or maybe even a couple shows back, I was having some trouble getting controllers to detect. That turned it out to be something really simple. Not all USB hubs are created equal. So the first one I was trying to use, for whatever reason, the first USB port in this four-port hub would work for my keyboard and also for this controller setup that I had, but the other ones didn't. So what ended up working, I just kind of, on a whim, I grabbed a a USB hub that came with the PlayStation 2 Rock Band game and used that, and it worked. Everything just kind of detected. It was a little weird. But anyway, once I did that, I had a couple of old PlayStation 2 controllers, and I bought this thing on eBay 10 years ago that's like a adapter that goes from those PS2 controllers to USB. And so that worked really well. And RetroPie is kind of already designed for that, you know, PlayStation kind of a setup. So it was perfect. Once I got that to detect, I had two PlayStation 2 controllers going, and I was even able to run sort of PlayStation 1 games on the Pi Zero, and it was a little laggy, but I had Tony Hawk kind of running, and I was impressed that it even worked as much as it did.
Yeah, that is impressive. And I think we might have the same PS2 adapter USB thing. This one's really cool because you plug it in and just Linux detects it as one big controller, and then you just map the buttons to each individual whatever button you want. It's pretty nifty.
Yeah, it is. It's just a, you know, little cheap piece of blue plastic that was like $5, you know.
Oh, wait a minute. I think we have the exact same one. Is it like translucent? You can kind of see inside of there?
Yes, sir.
Yep, we have the same exact one. That's hilarious.
Yeah, but it works really well on RetroPie. It detects it as twin USB joysticks and just works.
That's exactly my experience. Yeah, good find. That's a good one.
Yeah, so that's fine. The Zero is not quite powerful enough to do the PlayStation stuff, but you know, for all the older console stuff, it's working really well. And naturally, I just want to go get a 3B Plus so I can do Tony Hawk and have the wife play some Crash Bandicoot on it and all that kind of good stuff. But it was fun.
My wife just bought Crash Bandicoot. There's like some kind of all the original games or whatever for the Switch. So, yeah. Crash Bandicoot.
Oh, okay. Which is interesting because Crash was the, you know, PlayStation 1 kind of classic game.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who made the decision to bring it over to Switch, but as soon as she saw it, she had to have it. And it came with a controller, too, so, yeah, it worked out all right.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a PlayStation Classic that came out with, like, 20 pre-installed games, and it looks cool, but it's missing, like, there's no Tony Hawk, there's no Crash. I was reading a little bit, you can, you know, hack it, of course, and replace the pre-installed games with games of your choosing, but I was really surprised that some of the games I would consider to be staples weren't there.
Yeah, really. Guess to each their own, huh? But, well, to Sony, their own.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some licensing things that got in the way of some of that. I don't know the particulars or don't care to, really. But anyway, so that's what I'm
Tony Hawk was one of those games that was way ahead of its time when it came to just the movement and the music.
The music is what got me. I would just listen to the soundtrack.
I don't know how they handled all that licensing to get that good of music on those games. All of them.
Yep. That was definitely a standout to me. I was addicted to that. It's the first game, actually, I remember really playing for hours and hours without getting sick of it.
Yep. I was the same.
The only other game that I can really think of that I think of just for the music would be GTA Vice City, and that would be because it was one of the only games on PC where you could add any of your own music to it.
I remember that being a thing on the Tom Clancy games before that. You could do that with, like, Ghost Recon and some of those.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's the first time I remember seeing it.
All right, and just to keep the whole gaming theme going, Bo, you've got some more gaming info for us, too.
Yeah, but before we get into that, I was actually just looking at your partition issue, Tony. And
sweet.
I have no idea if this works, but I just Googled it while you were talking, and there's an application called Part Image. I don't know if anybody here has ever used that before, but it's an apt install Part Image, and it's a partition backup and migration tool, so maybe we should check that out for your problem.
All right, I've got that in a browser tab right now. Thanks.
Nice.
But back to the gaming. Mine's a little more successful than the Watch Dogs experience. There was a Steam sale over the holidays, as they always do, and Alan Wake was $2, so I picked it up. Why not? And I installed it within Steam using the Steam Proton feature. And it's a Windows native. It doesn't have a Linux version, but it installed perfectly. The game actually ran perfectly without any modification. There was just, I noticed that whenever my character was outside in the wooded area, which most of the game you are, it's a very outdoors game. Anything that all of the objects that were really, flat images, but with like a vector background, like say, for example, like grass, it would really be a big block, a big flat image of grass, but, it had a vector background so you could see through it and made it look more like grass and it would kind of wave and stuff like that. Well, on Linux, without any modification, those you couldn't see through the vector part. So it just looked like big squares, you know, spread it out through a field. But I actually looked it up and it was actually a problem on Windows. It wasn't a Linux native problem. It's just that most Windows versions of your NVIDIA or your Radeon drivers would have already had the settings correctly set to rule this out. But even on Windows, if you see this problem, all you have to do is go in and enable FXAA under anti-aliasing, and as long as that box is checked on your graphics drivers, not just within the game, because your graphics drivers actually override what's in the game, as long as you check that box, Windows or Linux, it fixes this problem. And other than that, I've almost beat the game. I'm at the end of the game now. I've had no issues. Everything's ran perfectly. It's just like the situation Tony described with Windows, where I actually forgot that I was on Linux. Like, I've been playing this game for hours, and it was the exact same experience that I would have had on Windows. So, score one for Steam Proton.
Very cool. We can stick a platinum on that one now too, huh?
Yeah, I think it might be rated platinum. I have to look that up and see.
If it's not, it should be. If you can get to the end of the game and not really have any issues except for checking a box, I think you're golden or platinum.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Awesome. And then Tony Hughes, just to keep the whole upgrade theme rolling too, you've got some too.
Yeah, I actually had a go at installing Linux Mint 19.1. the Mate version onto an old Lenovo X61S that I've got. I think I talked about it in another show. And it ran really sweet. Yes, it's got an SSD in it. Yes, it's got the maximum 4 GB of RAM. So it's not under-resourced as far as hardware goes. But, you know, for an 11-plus year old laptop, you know, it proves that old hardware isn't dead yet, kind of thing. So yeah, that's running quite nicely. I also updated any Mint 19 installs that I've got to Mint 19.1. Went smoothly, just went into the update manager, made sure that the Mint updater was the latest version, and then it showed the update path and went ahead, and like other people have said, it ran as smoothly as anything. It's great.
Very awesome.
Yeah, no problems at all with that. And I've also, just before Christmas, I went to my local Blackpool Lug Christmas party. We have a Lug and Makerspace here in Blackpool, and we have an annual event where we just all meet up on the last meeting before Christmas and just have a, you know, a few mince pies and a bit of jollity, as well as the making and the computing side of it. So that was good. And over Christmas, just after Christmas, I went up to Scotland, only got back this afternoon. So I've been away for a few days. And while I've been away, I've been, you know, watching some YouTube videos on restoring and customising die-cast metal cars. I bumped into a video on YouTube just accidentally and thought, oh, this is cool. So I've been hunting around and, you know, watching other people restore these old Matchbox and Dinky cars. I don't know whether anyone remembers all that and the red lines and things.
I still got mine.
You've still got yours. Yay. So I've been looking around on eBay to see if I can pick up any old ones and maybe have a go at doing a bit of work at the makerspace and trying to do a few up. But yeah, that's about all for me, apart from not feeling too good because I think I may have trapped a nerve in my back, but that's a different story.
That's part of the news section, right?
Yeah. We're all dropping like flies around here.
I know it. All right. Well, speaking of the news, let's head on that way. So we got a couple of news articles that we've been kind of gathering over the last couple of weeks, and we'll try and keep it short because we've got predictions coming up after this as well. The first one on the list is Oracle VirtualBox 6 released, and I think just about every single one of us has had touches on VirtualBox at least in some way. And a couple of the highlights on that is VirtualBox 6, if you use 32-bit OSs, you're going to have to stop because VirtualBox 6 no longer supports 32-bit OSs at all. So if you want to continue using 32-bit, do not upgrade to 6. Stick on 5 if you need that feature. But a couple of other things that VirtualBox 6 brings in with it is high DPI support. This is great. Because I run on, it's some kind of, it's a Microsoft Surface, so it's like extremely wonky on the resolution, but it's still considered high DPI and it pixel doubles all over the place. And if I forget to change the resolution to 1080, the mouse is extremely tiny, so you'll lose it a lot. But it looks like this high, I haven't tried it on the Surface yet, but high DPI support seems to be something that they've added into it, and I will report back next show whether or not that worked out well or not. And Linux kernel 4.20 support, so things should be running a lot more smoothly if you're using some of the newer Linux OSs.
Yeah, I've been having to play with this as well, and I spotted a problem earlier on this afternoon, whereas if I open up Windows, audio's working fine. If I open up a Linux virtual machine, the audio is all choppy or non-existent, depending on which virtual machine I'm running. I've been trying to do a bit of research on Google to see if I can...
I've actually seen that at my local lug. It is just a matter of going in and changing some of the settings in your audio under sound with inside the Linux box.
Or is it the changing... Linux VM. Is it changing like the... Oh, so it's in the Linux VM and not in...
Right.
Or is it the VM setting?
It's a matter of switching it. I think you have to... What is it? There's that drop-down that says analog stereo output, and you have to switch it to something else. I don't remember specifically, but it was an easy fix once we found it.
Okay. Yeah, right. I'll tinker with that a little bit and see if I can replicate that issue too.
Yeah, I was also getting choppy sound for some of it, and I don't know what's causing that, because that wouldn't be the input to the or the output from the sound device. I can't understand what was causing that, because like I say, on a Windows virtual machine, it was working fine.
Interesting. I've always had weird audio issues with VirtualBox in general, so I would always just strip out the audio card altogether and not worry about it. But then again, I guess if you're using it for sound, it kind of defeats the purpose of that.
Yeah.
And the last thing I'll say is I opened it up because we were talking about it, and then it hit me right in the face that the GUI has been overhauled. The way you select VMs and some of the options of those VMs are just right there in this little, I want to call it a hamburger menu. I think that's what this is, but the menu options are huge, so I don't know. But the way you get some of the settings is a little different now. But I think spend 5 minutes with it and you'll kind of get the hang of it. It's just muscle memory for me, because they changed from 4 to 5 and then they changed it again from 5 to 6. So, yeah, more relearning, I guess.
Yeah, I think most of that's just positioning where things are now. Once you actually get into the menus and start hunting around, most of the menus are actually the same. It's just where they've put them.
Right. And I thought the way that they did it in 5, where they had details and snapshots up in the top right-hand corner, and that just was not intuitive to me at all. I would forget it was up there. And I've used it since the original release of 5, and I never got used to it. It's just a weird one. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. And the next news article we have is that Linus Torvalds recently expressed his views on why Linux couldn't capture the desktop market. So has anybody read up on this one? Has anybody heard him talk about this?
No, I tried to open the link that's in our notes, and it pointed to something incorrect, so I wasn't able to read up on it.
Huh, sure enough, it redirects to email. That's funny. I think it was someone's email. Maybe they emailed themselves the link or something like that. But I know we can Google that one up. But he basically just said that there's too much fragmentation. And when people are I guess, offered way too many options, they would rather just not pick an option than be wrong. So right. They just won't. Yeah, that's the idea. And I really agree with that.
It's always been that's always been both a blessing and a curse for Linux, is the fragmentation. Because it's like you have a ton of options, and every time someone has, you know, a new idea or a new take on an existing option, it can be forked off and made into something new, which is a cool thing. But at the same time, considering people that may not be a part of the Linux community as deeply as we are, you just step in and you don't, well, which OS do I use? What's the best one? What's right for me? It seems like there's one for teachers and scientists. You know, I'm a plumber. What's the plumber version of Ubuntu? It just seems like, you know, there are so many options, and that's both a good thing and a bad thing. I can't see how it would be you know, frustrating or confusing to a new, you know, a newcomer to Linux.
Right. I love distro hopping. So that, I mean, that's the antithesis that's to that, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely, yeah, on the positive side is there's if you're somebody, you know, like us that enjoys trying out a new distro, setting it up the way you like it, and that is all part of the fun of doing it, then it's a great thing. There's a billion different ideas out there that you can, you know, try different ones. I don't know. It's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, but yeah, and I think the curse part comes in when you're trying to get the regular user on it, and yeah, you just can't decide, or if you do decide or whatever, you go Google something one time, and then there's 17 different articles about how to fix one thing or change one thing, and it's like, wait, this is not my desktop environment, and the fact that they don't even know what a desktop environment is a lot of times.
Oh yeah, dude. At work one day, I was looking at CentOS 6, and one of my coworkers that is a Windows person, he noticed that the desktop environment was different than whatever version of Linux he saw at his previous job. And he was like, oh, wow, they upgraded the layout. And I was like, oh, well, it's just, you know, this is like one of like 1,000. Like it could be, we could just as easily install, you know, XFCE or something else on here. And that's, to somebody that is, you know, not deeply rooted in this community, that is a foreign idea to them, you know, that you could choose, you can install Linux and decide that you don't want to use XFCE, you can use something else. I mean, that's an option that Mac and Windows users just are completely foreign to.
Right, absolutely. Too much choice. It'll get you every time. Speaking of too much choice, the next article that we have on here is KDE Plasma is now available as a snap. So if you have any new users to Linux, go ahead and tell them this and how to install it, and then you can really blow their minds with having more than one DE.
I wanted to put this out there, too, so I didn't get to try this. I put this in the show notes because Fugly, Fugly messaged us, that was his name, messaged us saying that he wanted us to try KDE Plasma out on Linux Mint, and so I did that. And so I saw this article with the snap package, and I thought, you know, it was kind of related to our recent comment from Fugly, so I put it in the show notes. But I can't actually test the snap because I already have KDE on here. So I actually was thinking if Fugly's listening, he wants to try out the snap image and maybe write back to us and let us know if it worked. That being said, if you brick your system, it's not our fault, right?
That snap image, it even says in the article, is not ready for prime time.
Oh,
it does
really?
Not interact well with launching any other application. It is indicative of the future to come where they're trying to really isolate each and every program, which, you know, it's good for security, bad for how much storage it's going to take up. But this is definitely just a preview, just a test. There's not a whole lot you can do with it.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do then. I'm itching to reinstall on my system anyway because I want to do 19.1, and I've made some changes on here. I want to revert. So I might actually install, fresh install of Linux Mint, try the snap and just see how it works, and then I'll just use the opportunity to reinstall again and actually set it up the way I normally have it set up. So I may try that out. I'll make a note to test that maybe before 301.
I'll dive in and bork my system with you. It'll work. What's the worst that could happen, right? I have to reinstall. That's not too bad. I have all my crap on a different drive, so it works out. And then speaking of snaps, I feel like we put this together on purpose. Like it's got a flow to it now. But speaking of snaps, we have the top snaps in 2018. And this is from the Ubuntu blog themselves. And as you would expect, you would see number one at Spotify, number two at Slack, number three, VLC. And I was kind of surprised to see server stuff being used because I think a lot of the people that use snaps, and I'm probably way wrong about this, are desktop users, right? I mean, if you're seeing Spotify at number one, then a lot of desktop users are using right, snaps. Yeah. But number four, we see Nextcloud. And I think that's awesome. I had played with Nextcloud a little bit in a snap, and it was way easier than I thought. I did not have to set up a LAMP stack to make Nextcloud work.
I set up Nextcloud when it was like first coming out, very early days, and that was a pain. It was horrible to try and set that up.
Because you had to do the whole LAMP stack, right?
Right. The whole LAMP stack, plus you had to adjust the size if you wanted file sizes over such and such. It was really terrible to set up. And then you were supposed to do that on every computer that you wanted it working on, and it was just a pain. And there was no way I was going to keep doing that. I'm really glad to see a snap. Maybe I'll give it a try again.
Wow.
Yes, I really do recommend you try it again, because if you like Nextcloud or like the idea of having kind of like a central storage where you can log in and all that, Nextcloud's the way to do it. And there's a --- option for just about anything that you would have to go into the config file and change.
Right. Well, I'm still a big fan of BT Sync just for overall simplicity and usability. So I will give Nextcloud a try. But I'm not giving up my BT Sync.
That's okay, because, I mean, with the snap, it's just snap install, and then if you hate it, snap remove. Easy peasy. And it doesn't change anything else on your entire system. Everything goes away with it. It's a beautiful thing, snaps.
And BT Sync is Resilio Sync now, right?
Right. It has changed names to Resilio Sync.
Just in case anybody out there was wanting to try it out, because you gave it such a good recommendation.
And is this like, I forget what it's called, but it was like a torrent sync of some kind. Is that how that works?
Yeah, it originally started out as a BitTorrent sync and then changed its name to BT sync.
That makes sense.
Now it's Resilio sync.
I see. So like a resilient sync. Okay. It works out pretty good.
And they switched to BT sync about the time they tried to change their pay model, because it was originally all in beta, and then it was free at first, and then they took away a lot of the free functionality and put it all behind a paywall, and basically everybody, even me, stopped using it for a year and a half, and then they figured out that they were losing their entire customer base. So they do still have paid models that do provide more, but they put back all that free functionality that was there previously.
That's pretty much the Linux paradigm, isn't it? Like, get you hooked with the free stuff, and then, you know, if you want more than whatever, you start paying for it or something like that. Okay.
But don't take away the free stuff that you've already given.
Right. Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, don't put that stuff behind a paywall. That's silly.
Yep.
Then further down that news article list, we have Android Studio, which obviously I think there's a lot of that stuff that's floating around. Everybody likes making Android apps. And Discord, Plex Media Server, this was the other one, because I had just moved Plex Media Server maybe a couple of months ago over to a snap, and man, it's nice. It's just super nice. And then Zenotic, someone said something yesterday about Zenotic, that how did that make it onto the list or something like that?
Oh yeah, I just thought it was weird, because I just think to be the eighth most popular snap, and I've never heard of this game. It's apparently like a arena-style first-person shooter. I don't know. That's pretty
crazy. You haven't played Zenotic?
No, I've never played it. Have you played it?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things I installed and played because it's kind of fun.
Well, I just must have missed the boat. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, maybe I had heard of it, but I surely didn't remember it. So I'm kind of in the same boat as you, Bo, but I kind of want to try it because I grew up playing Unreal Tournament.
It is very similar. That was the whole reason I got it, was because, you know, it was made for Linux, and it was a lot like Unreal.
Yes, yeah. I spent many a high school hour playing Unreal in the computer lab. And further down the list, we have Notepad++. And this is the one, like, I could totally see Xenotic being on the list, but I totally can't see Notepad++ being on the list. What is up with this? I love it. It's an amazing Windows app.
Something simple and small for people to install?
I guess, but why not just Gedit or Kate or whatever DE you're running on, whatever theirs is, because they all have the same kind of functionality, don't they?
Well, no.
Question mark?
No, definitely not. I mean, Gedit's kind of cool, and it's one of the first things I install when I put on a fresh copy of Linux Mint, but Notepad++, just for how it organizes things when you're typing, is hugely awesome. Now, it's a little bit more advanced than the stuff that I would need it for, but I know a lot of people that just swear by Notepad++ much more than Gedit or anything else.
Yeah, it's certainly the very first app I install on a new Windows box, though, so I'll give it that.
Right.
Right, that's the weird thing, is that this must have to run in Wine.
Yes, and it does. It pulls down the whole Wine stack and everything, so I can't imagine it's as small as it is on Windows.
A snap that runs Wine. That has some really awesome implications.
I know it, right?
I mean, a Steam snap, that's the Windows version.
Well, that's not too far-fetched because, and I do not condone this at all, there were a lot of pirated games that were packaged with Flatpak and it for Linux that were Windows games, so that was also packaged with Wine, too. So, just interesting. It's, yeah, so much Windows software.
Cool.
And then last on the list at 10 was Shotcut. So, you had to, yeah. For video editors, you made the list. There's enough video editors on Linux, or at least using Snap, that got Shotcut onto the list. So, just a really cool list of software. If you haven't heard of any of that stuff and you're into any of those things, yeah, go grab it. Go grab the Snap. Snaps are getting bigger and better all the time. And then a little further down the list on our news articles, we have Windows is coming to Chromebooks. Dun, dun, dun.
yeah, so there's lots of talk right now about Google's Project Campfire, which is it's basically dual booting on Chromebooks, but they call it Alt OS. So you'll be able to boot up your Chromebook and use this Alt OS feature to choose a different OS other than the Chrome OS that comes natively installed on the Chromebook. And they're even saying that as long as it's a 64 gig or higher Chromebook, then they would have the ability to boot Windows 10. Now, this Project Campfire, this Alt OS feature, is currently only slated to be available on the Pixels, the high-end Google Chromebooks. But you gotta imagine if it's really successful there, they'll probably branch it out to other models. Go ahead.
Wouldn't there be quite a bit of hardware limitation? Because Chromebooks definitely. Your lower, well, not necessarily lower end, but smaller spec devices for a reason.
Well, that's why they're looking at the Pixels first, because
right,
they're the higher
those
end
are way
ones.
OP
yeah,
for a Chromebook.
The thing I think is weird about it is, well, why, for one thing, like, why is the main thing I question I have. But, you know, like, the Chromebook, the whole premise behind the Chromebook is they cost $300. Like, they have low specs. They're made to run Chrome OS. Chrome OS is really lightweight and built for this device, and that's why it runs well. And Google's whole thing is they sell the Chromebook at cost or even less because they want you to use Google services. They're going to make money off of you seeing Google ads, and they learn more about you, and that's where they're making the money off the back end, not off selling you the hardware of the Chromebook. And so, to me, giving a user an option to just buy a $300 Chromebook and then put Windows 10 on it and just never boot into Chrome OS again, just users having that option seems like a terrible idea to me. I don't understand from a business sense why they would do this. And just as, you know, we're all Linux geeks here and we want to see people use Linux, just from that perspective, you know, Chrome OS was moving in a direction where, you know, we were going to be able to run Linux native applications on future Chromebooks and even current Chromebooks with Crouton. And this is just encouraging people to step away from that and to go back to Windows 10 again. This seems like bad news for everybody.
This sounds like the old netbook fiasco back in 2009-2010. You know, when they first released netbooks, they were Linux based.
That's right.
And then they were finding that they weren't selling that many of them, so they went and managed to get Windows XP stuck on them, a very low power version of that, and that increased the sales of them, and that killed the Linux machines.
Yeah, you know, the first year I worked at Best Buy was, it must have been around 2009, 2010, because we did sell netbooks that were made by Asus, I think, and they had Ubuntu on it. You could pay $100 more and get a Windows version, Windows 7, I think, or it was $100, you know, cheaper to get the Ubuntu version, and nobody bought the Ubuntu version.
Yeah, that happened over here as well.
Yep, you had to actually put some work into it if you wanted Windows on it, and I think it was worth $100 to some people to just not deal with it.
I missed that entirely. I didn't realize that in a big box store that anything was even sold with Ubuntu on it at any point. I completely wasn't aware of that.
That's the only time that I know of is that. What, now they sell them in big box stores?
What is it, the XPS 13 Developer Edition, or can you only get that on the website?
I think you
it's
can
only online.
Online, yeah.
Oh, okay, so it's not in the big box store.
Right.
But back on the Chromebook point, I think they're doing just what Apple did, and it's just to give you the choice, because sometimes there's just something that you have to run on your machine that is not going to run in Chrome OS, and if they can keep you on their device, I mean, they're still kind of retaining you, just not to the degree I suspect that they would want you to be on their ecosystem or something.
I think that makes...
They did still sell you a device.
Yeah, but they sold it to you at a loss. They sold it to you at a loss. Like, the difference is that you buy a MacBook and it's $1,300, and it really only cost Apple, you know, $500. Whereas when you buy a Chromebook, it's $250, $350, and that device may have actually cost the manufacturer more than that to make. But they're making the money from you using their services, which you're not doing if you're booting into Windows 10.
I think the Pixelbook is a lot like the Mac in that there's no way that thing costs $900, $1,200, $1,500 to put together. There's no way.
Right. Right, and one of my predictions on this is I think it may be limited to that. I don't think, you know, there's a part of me that thinks that if it's hugely successful and it gets people buying Chromebooks, maybe they'll put it on some of their, you know, lower end Chromebooks. But I gotta think they're gonna keep the price. They're only gonna do it on the high price range Chromebooks because of that exact reason.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, and I mean, what does Google care? If they, I think their thinking is, if you're going to boot into Windows because you need to do this thing or that thing, you'll still have Chrome OS around, and even if you're in Windows, you're probably using the Google Chrome browser anyway.
That's true. That's true.
And on top of that, I think
also,
go ahead, Tony.
I was going to say also, are they going to come with the Windows license pre-installed, or are you going to have to go out and spend $100 or £100 in this country and get a Windows license?
You have to get the Windows license.
Install media.
Yeah, that kind of goes to the point that I was going to bring up, and that's that, like, people aren't going to do it. Like, they're just not. I have tons of people that run Mac, that have Mac hardware in my classes, and I'm like, hey, why don't you just boot camp it? Why don't you just put Windows on it? You get free Windows keys through the school anyway. Why don't you just do that? And they're like, okay. And then a couple weeks later, I'm like, hey, so how'd the boot camp go? Oh, I didn't do it. I just kept using my Mac. I'm doing it in a VirtualBox. And I'm like, okay. And so these are people that
that's because most of them don't have the skills to put it on.
No, here's the thing. Here's the thing. They're in classes for these skills. These are the skills I'm teaching them to do. So even technically apt students will not do it.
Yeah.
Right, and you still need the license to run it in VirtualBox.
Exactly. Well, we use their trial, 90-day thingamajig, but that's the idea. I mean, you still need, if you're going to use it long-term, you still need the license.
A lot of the difference there, too, though, is that if you have a Mac, you can install programs on it. Chrome OS, not so much. So you have fewer options on Chrome OS and may have more of a practical need to be able to at least occasionally use programs where you need another OS.
Yeah. Now, I know you were talking about it a minute ago, but what is the actual state of being able to run Linux applications on a Chromebook without, you know, reinstalling Linux?
You absolutely can do it now. I actually have a Chromebook in front of me that's running Arch, but I had to hack it to do that. From Google specifically, they have a technology, but it's not in most of their Chromebooks yet. I don't even know if it's actually in the Pixel yet, but it's planned to be if it's not already. So right now you can do it with Crouton. Just anybody can on just about any Chromebook. But an official supported Google one also exists, whether it's available on most Chromebooks right now, or I'm not sure.
Cool. Now, Crouton is what you use to be able to install a full version of Linux.
Yeah, it basically, so whenever I boot my laptop up, it still comes up to Chrome OS, and then I can, within a tab, run a Linux terminal and actually launch an X server, and it takes over my screen, and now I'm running. So it's still running in Chrome OS.
All right, and then we'll hit the last news
article. Still not going to buy a Chromebook.
Yeah, I don't think I would either. They're pretty nice, though, I guess. Well, speaking of operating systems, we got one last news article on the list, and that is the 5 best Linux distros of 2018, and Mint made the list.
Yes, it did. And now I'll be careful about calling this hard news, but this is from OMG Ubuntu, and they did their roundup of the 5 top distros of 2018, and this was based on voting on their Telegram channel. But, you know, as far as audience polls, that's probably as legit as I expect you could get. And the 5, and they say these are not in any particular order, but probably not surprising, they listed Ubuntu proper first. And right behind that, Linux Mint 19.1 Tessa. Yeah. And the other few that are on this list are Fedora 29, Elementary OS 5. And the last one was a bit of a surprise to me. It was Void Linux. I would have expected maybe Solus or something there. I think I've heard of Void Linux, but I've certainly not used it myself. Not sure if you guys have.
I heard it mentioned on a podcast a couple of days ago, but apart from that, I haven't played around with it or anything.
Yeah, same here.
One of the things I thought I would just kind of mention that they noted here is that they say that it's a go-to option for single board PC users like Raspberry Pi users. Other than like Ubuntu Mate, I wasn't really aware of a lot of desktop OS you could use on the Pi, so I might play with that just for fun.
Interesting. Okay, so I can definitely get behind it on that one. And it's kind of surprising that Solus didn't make the list, and I feel like that the whole Aiki issue was probably to blame for a lot of that.
Yeah, they had an unusual year, you know?
And they really did. Sure, but the product itself is still pretty rock solid. I haven't had any issues
right,
with it.
Yeah.
I have one box anymore that runs Solus, and I touch it every now and then, and you know, nothing's blown up since. And it's kind of surprising for the semi-rolling release that they do.
There were some honorable mentions to Zorin, Manjaro, Bodai, and React OS. Not to go into this too deep, but I had considered trying out React OS. I've got some really old like DOS games, and I know you can do that on DOSBox and stuff like that, but I thought about just giving that a try on React OS for giggles and see how it goes.
I keep thinking about React OS, and I never dug in it far enough to know, but is React OS just Wine?
No, it is. It's a Linux-based Windows compatibility OS that's meant to run Win32 programs. So I think that's the main intent of it. I don't think it's Wine per se. I don't know enough about it to explain why that's different, but the OS is just targeted at that compatibility, and I don't think it uses the same technology as Wine.
Okay. Yeah, because they got really popular. They've been around for a long time, but they got really popular like maybe 6 months ago or something, and I think they maybe did a major release or something like that, and it kind of cleared up some issues for people. But yeah, I just kind of always assumed it was just, I don't know, like a Windows GUI look-alike thing wrapped up in Wine, but maybe not. Yeah. I'll have to dig into it because that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I gather it's like a Windows NT-ish kind of a feel. It's one of the things I've been meaning to play around with.
Yeah, okay. Maybe that's something I need to check out over the new year. Well, that's it for our news, and we'll mosey on into our Linux innards section, which is a little bit different today. right. So Linux Inner is going to be a little bit different. I know we had promised the Snap Flatpak thing, but we're gonna push that off for a couple more episodes. So I think it's going to be the second episode of the new year that we'll really go all in on that. But for right now, we've got a few predictions that we want to get out there and get ahead of. And we'll start with you, Joe. So give us some predictions. What do you think is going to happen this year in Linux?
Well, I know we already talked about Windows 10 on Chromebooks, which is interesting, but I think that Microsoft is going to be trying to get on to the smaller, lower-end, lower-power devices with a Edge OS. We already know that Edge is coming on Chromium, but I think they're going to do an Edge OS based on Chromium, and this will allow them onto more tablets, smaller tablets, cheaper tablets, and more into the education space. So I'm expecting by this time, this time next year, we should see at least one device out on the market or the operating system available to install. And also, moving on from that, I think we're going to see a DeX Linux device that is actually usable from Samsung this year. I'm really hoping it's the S10 or whatever they end up calling it. But I'm expecting this year we should see something out on the market that has a dock. You can hook it up and it would be a full Linux operating system that you see on your screens.
I think that is... I think that's one of the most likely predictions. Like, I was going to add that to my list and I saw you had it. Not only that, but I have a prediction for 2020. I think 2019 Samsung is going to come out with a DeX Linux development or device. And then I think Apple is going to come out with theirs in 2020 because they're going to take whatever Samsung or whatever company does it. And I think they're going to expand on it and do their version of it in 2020.
Yep, I really do agree with that because they're already doing ARM chips in the MacBook Air, aren't they?
With Apple, it's going to be at least two other major companies are going to release something like the DeX before that happens.
Before Apple
they're
does
always
it?
Like, yeah, before Apple does it. Well, of course, they'll say that they're the first ones that did it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and that was going to be the next point, is whenever it happens in 2020, then Apple fans will act like it never existed before. But I think that they're getting a little hastier. Like, as a matter of fact, if you really wanted to be bold, you might could even say Apple might do it in 2019. I just think we would have already heard rumors of it by now. But
we'd have seen something.
Lately, they've been a little, they used to be, like you said, where they were staying, they would hold back, they'd hold their cards. You wouldn't know what they were working on, and then they would, perfect something that was invented by somebody else, and they would launch it as if it was something brand new. But I think lately they've been chasing the market a little bit more. Like, ever since Steve Jobs passed away, I feel like they are way quicker at the draw, and they are more likely now to rush something out than they were before. And so I think 2020 is pretty likely. I think you could even be bold and make the prediction that Apple may do it by the end of 2019.
Ooh, can I mark you down for that one?
Sure. Are we going to take notes on this?
Yeah. I'm gonna hold you all's feet to the fire around December next year.
Okay. And for my last prediction, I think this year we're going to see a Linux distro that uses Snap for all of its applications by design. Now, that's not saying that you won't be able to go and install another software manager and still use apt or anything like that, but it's going to be designed and distributed to use snaps for everything.
Didn't Ubuntu already do that one? They have Snappy Core or something like that. It was like a stripped down image of Ubuntu.
Good,
that
then I already got one right.
There you go. Nice. All right, Joe, 1 point for Joe. We'll have to wait 12 months to see if anybody else earns any points. That's right. Go ahead.
I'm just going to look it up and try to see if I can find something, find out if that really does already exist.
I think it does. And look for Snappy Core. That sounds about right. It was a special image you put on, like, Raspberry Pis or whatever, and then everything was installed via Snap, I think. Pretty sure.
I think what Joe is saying is that you'll have, like, a base installation like almost like arch level, like you've got nothing, and then the everything else will be built within snaps on top of that. So your window manager, everything will be a snap, and they'll probably advertise it as if this is safer security, like you're protected because everything's in its own snap, and I feel like that'll be their lingo on it.
Yeah, go check out Snappy Core, because I think you're hitting all of their highlights for it. And now with the advent of the KDE Snap, we're getting really close. So as far as being able to do the GUI and everything else, I think Joe's prediction is still kind of floating out there, because it's not quite ready there. The GUI's not fully out there yet, but I think it will be. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. But the underpinning is definitely there. The everything is a snap.
All right, we'll have to look into it. I looked up Snappy Core, and I got Snap Score and Snapchat Scoring.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to go back, and maybe while everybody else is doing their predictions, I'll go and dig it up real quick. But I know it exists, so I'll have to go find it. All right, so I've got a couple of predictions myself, and they are both, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, we'll see, Microsoft related. So we've been talking about Edge OS, maybe that's going to be a thing, but I think before that happens, we'll see Microsoft Edge available for install in Linux. So we've got VS Code, we've got PowerShell, we've got, what else is over here? I don't know, all kinds of fun stuff, but I think Edge is going to be another contender there, and it's going to be sitting next to Firefox and Chrome and Chromium and Vivaldi and everybody else that's got a browser on Linux. So Microsoft Edge will be available for Linux in 2019. And it's just the whole Chromium thing. They're built on it. It won't be too difficult, I don't suspect, to port over. And it might just be some crazy guy that just throws it out on GitHub and is like, yeah, fend for yourself, but it'll be there. It'll be there. Then my other prediction is the opposite way around. GUI applications will be officially supported in the Windows subsystem for Linux. So I don't know what application it's going to be, but it's going to be something where you can launch Windows subsystem for Linux and click on a button, and the Linux GUI application will show up on your screen. But the difference is, I know that already exists, but the difference is Microsoft will support it. It'll just be a install in the Windows Store or just a command line something or another. It's that it'll be officially supported.
Well, they only need to support one, and that's X11.
Ah, that's exactly right, though. So there we go. Okay, then I'll refine it. That GUI applications via X11, because X11 is supported in WSL, GUI will be supported in the Windows subsystem for Linux. It's going to happen. It's going to happen, and I think it's going to happen next year.
I actually think both of those are pretty safe bets. I definitely see Microsoft Edge coming to Linux. I think that's 100% happening. And then I work in an environment where every employee has a Windows machine, but yet many of us work with Linux applications. And so not even just from a desktop user perspective, I could see a corporate reason why you would want to have Microsoft supported X11 GUI applications on Windows. So, I mean, I definitely think there's a market need for that.
Yep, there's money to be made, and I think that's
now work just needs to let me, run Windows subsystem for Linux.
Yeah, I don't know if yours is like ours, but it's turned off by Active Directory. But if you Microsoft has the app images available online, and you can sideload the app images, and then subsystem for Linux will work. Even though Active Directory doesn't allow you to install things from the App Store. So anyway, not that I've ever done that.
Yeah, but only on Windows 10, right?
What's that?
But only on Windows 10, right?
Yes, only on Windows 10, correct.
Yeah, I'm out of luck.
Yeah, well, see, maybe you just need to jump on that Windows 10 train. And you can
work
feel all
needs
the
to jump on that Windows 10.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say, so they you can will. You can start messing with all the update woes that everybody else has to deal with.
Nah, 7's bad enough.
Yeah, definitely. All right, and Bo, you got some predictions for us too, yeah?
Oh yeah, this 2019, the year of the Proton desktop. This is what I want to see happen. But I think there's a really good chance that we will see a lot of growth in Steam Proton and Valve support for Linux. Already, there's so many games that work. using the beta testing version of Steam Proton, I feel like the officially supported list is going to grow exponentially in 2019. I would go so far as to say 25 to 50% official support, and I think that game developers are going to advertise the fact that they are Proton available. I don't think anybody. I don't think they're going to start pushing that it's a Linux native game, because that would imply that you could just install it and run it without having Steam. But I think game developers are going to develop their games for Windows, but in such a way that they'll be available via Steam Proton.
Right. That seems a lot easier than, you know, rewriting the game so that it runs on Linux. Just provide a couple of tweaks and make it a little smoother so that it actually loads and runs in Proton. Get rid of the hurdles that, you know, home users have.
So for my prediction to work, I think we're going to start seeing games that actually advertise the fact that, because obviously, you know, obviously many games work now on Steam Proton, but I think we're actually going to start seeing game developers, they may start with indie developers, maybe Kickstarter style games, but I think we're going to start seeing, like, in the actual advertising available for Steam Proton.
Okay, I like that one, and that's I can't wait. I hope you're right.
Yeah, maybe I'm hoping more than anything else. And then, I don't know what my prediction is for Ubuntu, but they've been toying with going public. But then also the recent purchase of Red Hat. I have noticed a change on the Ubuntu blog. I don't know if you guys follow the Ubuntu blog. I get stuff for the show notes sometimes from there. And it used to be very desktop directed. And ever since the purchase of Red Hat, I've noticed more and more articles. Not that they didn't do it before, but I just feel like it's a lot more now. Articles directed towards Kubernetes, towards Docker, the more corporate server side of Ubuntu. And I really feel like they're setting up for either a public IPO of their, you know, of their stock in their company, or some sort of purchase by another company. And I think it would be a competitor to IBM. Obviously, we're all thinking of Microsoft, but I think just a major competitor of IBM.
No, some of that might be that they're trying to capitalize on the change with Red Hat and IBM. They know that some users are going to be concerned about what's happening with that company, or they're hoping that IBM is going to make enough changes that the consumers are concerned, and they'll need an alternative. And they're hoping to be that alternative.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So do you think that they are not seeking public purchase, or that they are?
Well, if they go IPO, then, you know, somebody's going to buy up the stocks. I don't think they're planning on selling, and I hope they're not planning on going IPO, but it's possible. IBM paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
Everybody's for sale at some price.
Right, exactly.
That's very true.
You'll have to help me remember, but we reported an article where Mark Shuttleworth said that they weren't looking into being purpose. I can't remember his exact wordings, but we talked about that about a month ago.
He had no future plans for the company to be sold.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was it. IPO was still on the table, but it wasn't ready yet, but they definitely weren't selling.
Right.
I'll bet that in 2019 they go IPO, and we see a major company buy a ton of their stock, close to half.
But you're telling me that if somebody offered them $60 billion that they wouldn't sell? I mean, come on.
Oh, right. Exactly.
You'll blow the market up. They wouldn't accept it. I would hope they wouldn't accept it.
Everybody's got a price.
Yep. And so, Tony Watts, we got some predictions from you too, right?
Yep. And Bo was talking about maybe having some wishful thinking component on these. I think that's definitely a theme on mine. So I want to make you guys a deal. It's kind of like I'm betting on the lame horse in the race on all of these. So I think I get, you know, extra points if I get any of these. Okay.
2 points okay. For anyone you get right.
So I'm going to say that Nintendo will release a Nintendo 64 Classic in 2019. And that's actually kind of contrary to what Nintendo has actually said. They said they don't have any future plans to do this as of now. But I'm going to say they'll do it anyway in 2019, and that it will come preloaded with GoldenEye, or else what are we even doing here? And it's going to run Linux.
The PlayStation one runs Linux, doesn't it?
The Nintendo ones do for sure. The PlayStation one, I'm not super sure about.
Yeah, so I don't feel like that's too far-fetched of a prediction outside of the fact that Nintendo was like, we don't want to do N64.
Well, with the N64, I mean, it's not like most of the lower-end stuff that we have out right now for systems on a chip will play it. So they'd have to do some pretty hefty upgrading. Because if you just look at, like, the Raspberry Pi, it doesn't do N64 very well. I mean, you can get some of the games to play with overclocking and some serious tweaking, but that's a lot of work.
The Raspberry Pi people said that this is the last generation of this type of Pi. The new Pi they come out with is going to be so beefy that it'll be able to do N64, and I think Nintendo will jump on top of that, shove it in a plastic case, and sell it to you at $100.
Yeah,
but is the price going to shoot up on the Raspberry Pi?
Well, that's the thing. I think price is the big thing, because I got to be able to do this for about that $100 mark. So I think this is something, as far as the N64 thing, it'll be coming probably 2020 or something. 2019 might be a little early, but yeah, it'll happen.
Yeah, as far as the Pi goes, the price is going to be $35. That's their commitment.
Yeah. Another prediction I came up with that I'm just kind of really hoping for is that the Librem 5 will ship in 2019. It was supposed to ship in January. Obviously, that's not happening. But I'm going to go ahead and say it will ship within the year, and it will happen at the latter part of the year, by this time next year.
See, now you got me.
They're not going to start on the Librem 11 until after they finish the 5.
Right. You got me to extend to you extra points, but I don't think these are that far-fetched.
All right, well, I haven't got to the last one yet.
Oh,
so
here we go.
We'll at least agree on extra points for this last one, because I added it while we were talking, because I got really sad when we talked about the fact that there was an Ubuntu netbook at Best Buy, and that was a thing that happened, and there's nothing like that now. And also, when we were talking about the fragmentation of Linux being a deterrent and all that, I think it's because, there isn't a Linux version that you just get when you buy this thing at the store. If there was, it would probably be Ubuntu proper, and maybe people would know that name and know that everything else is variants. But anyway, I digress. I'll just say the prediction I have here, and this is a real long shot, but I'm going to say a big box store will sell a computer in 2019 with desktop Linux pre-installed at a discount, as opposed to the Windows variant.
I don't think that's that far-fetched, because the reason why it failed in 2009 was for good reason. Just Ubuntu wasn't as good back then as it is today. People didn't live on the internet the way they do today. The reason why Chromebooks are so successful is because you don't need to install, Word on your computer anymore. And the user base didn't understand that in 2009. So they were buying these Ubuntu machines and then going to the next aisle over and buying a copy of Microsoft Office and then wondering why it's not working on their product. So I definitely think that the user base is ready for it now where they weren't in 2009. So I think this is actually a really good prediction.
Yep, I agree.
Awesome.
Yep.
Well, I hope so.
I think all three of those are going to come true. I'll throw my hat on those too.
All right. I don't need the handicap. I feel good now.
Well, good. All right. See, we slyly convinced him to give up his bonus points. And Tony Hughes, you have a prediction for us too, yeah?
I do. And you almost spoilt it when you were talking about the Raspberry Pi a few minutes ago.
Oh, no.
Because my prediction is we will see a new Raspberry Pi launched in 2019. And it'll have a lot better hardware. It'll be USB 3. I think it'll be at least 2 gig of RAM. Maybe even have an M2 SATA port or something equivalent to it, so that you can have the choice between either an SD card or better, a better capacity and a better speed for the onboard hard drive. Obviously, if that all happens, it's going to have a new board format. But as you already said, they've got a commitment to keeping the $35 price point. So can this happen?
Oh, that
It'd
would be
nice
awesome
if it could.
Did.
Yep, absolutely.
It would, wouldn't it?
Oh, and then it would shake up the market so bad.
If you could slap an M2 into that thing, oh man, right. I don't.
An M2, two gigs of RAM, $35 with USB 3. Yeah, that would just be epic.
Yeah, the SD card is one of the big reasons why it's so slow. Yeah.
You know what they could do is they could just have, so they could keep the Raspberry Pi at $35, but then have some sort of add-on board that plugs into it with these extra features.
Okay, you know,
increase the modularity.
Yeah, you know they're doing that, right? The Pi B3 Pluses have a PoE hat where you can just power them over Ethernet, and the hat's like $20 or $30.
Yeah, there's all sorts of add-on boards that you can already get for the current Pi format, but I think they'll actually go with a new board at some stage. Something similar to the, what is it, Pine 64, because they already support different hard drive technology on the Pine 64.
Yeah, there's a couple of companies that do, but they're all more expensive once you start adding on those things. I mean, you're looking in the $80, $90, $120 range.
Yeah, we'll just have to see. It's a long shot, and it might happen, but maybe not next year. But I'm going to go for next year.
Okay, I agree. I like that prediction. That's a good one.
Yeah, I've got a couple of Mossy's predictions. I know he's not with us, but I think we should at least go with what he was going to predict, so that we can come back to it next year. His first one is that Microsoft will once again buy into SUSE with the intent to build a Windows 11 on the Linux kernel. That's a cool one. What do others think about that?
I think that's bold for next year.
We all kind of said something similar, but that's very specific. I like how he's going about that right there.
So Windows,
we all see Microsoft edging in more into the open source space and trying to take it over.
So Windows said
edging in more.
Yeah. Windows said that they weren't going to use numbers anymore. So can I assume that Windows 11 will just be Windows, whatever comes after 10, after they stop the numbers?
It'll be XI.
Windows?
I think it'll be Windows UX.
It'll be XI.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah. And then Mossy's other prediction, which is relating to our next show, he predicts that episode 300 will break the 3,000 download barrier.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. I'll go with that one.
Yeah, me too.
So that's our predictions for this year. But our listeners, maybe you've got some other predictions that you could let us know about. We've got channels on Reddit, MeWe, Mintcast.org, obviously. So if you've got some others that we've not mentioned, maybe you could post them in there and we'll read them out at some time on the next show if we get chance, or the one after.
I need to put MeWe in the intro.
Yeah, you could do.
Yeah, yes. Next show, expect MeWe in the intro. All right. And then so now that we got our predictions all figured out, we'll head on over to Vibrations from the Ether. All right. And then we have Tony Watts taking this first one. This is just a continuation off of something that we had been talking about last show.
Yes, we got an email asking for some feedback about the Asus Tinkerboard, which none of us on the show here had a lot of direct experience with. But we got some comments from Joshua Hawk on MeWe that might help. So the listener that wrote in, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, I believe it's Jan, was having an issue with the Tinkerboard not wanting to boot and thought it might have been related to the monitor. So what Joshua has said is, he said he's had this issue a lot with his Tinkerboard, and the solution was to make sure the monitor is on before starting the Tinkerboard. It can't be in sleep mode or off. The Tinkerboard won't wake the monitor like a lot of other things will, and so you need to make sure the monitor is on and not in sleep, and that will hopefully fix that issue. The Tinkerboard does boot in that situation, but it does not send the output signal to the monitor. So make sure the monitor's on, and I hope that might help.
Yeah, and if that does work for you, Jan, please let us know. I'd like to know if that's the answer or not.
Yep.
And then we have another one from Christopher Patrick from the mintcast.org site. He said, the last couple of episodes, I've noticed it say MP3 on the AUG feed. I was wondering if you stopped doing the AUG version of the podcast. And I think Joe had something on that.
Yeah, I've been doing the uploads on that recently. And I went back and looked just to make sure that the work was done right. And I'm not seeing the issue. It looks like the OGGs are correctly marked, correctly tagged, and the MP3s are properly tagged and in the right order. I know we have had some issues initially on a couple of episodes where we uploaded the wrong one to the OGG feed or the wrong one to the MP3 feed, but we have gone back and corrected those. So if you could point out the issue, send us some screenshots, show us what you're talking about, because I'm not even seeing where the title is mistitled on the OGG feeds. So if you can get back to us, let us know where we're messing that up, and we'll try and correct that going forward.
Yeah, I think he might have just gotten the wrongly uploaded one for that few minutes that it was up. That's probably what ended up happening.
Okay.
All right, and then Tony Hughes has the last bit.
Yeah, we got another bit of feedback from Brian36 in Dorset in England. He says, "Hi guys, welcome and many thanks for the new shows. My tastes are broad where Linux is concerned, but I major on Linux Mint. I only use Windows or OCR and TomTom on updates. Why do they use Linux inside but Windows outside? I'm with Linux Mint 18.3 till I get Wine sorted, as I use ham radio software. I have a Raspberry Pi, so I don't mind talk on that. I'm more of a user and a tinkerer where necessary. I do subscribe to Mint once a year, so I think he's saying he gives a donation once a year. And then he just says best wishes. So that's great. Thanks, Brian."
Thanks. All right, and then we have a couple of bits of info in the Check This Out section as we start to wrap up the show a little bit. So, Joe, tell us a little bit about what you put down there.
Well, the first link I added was for this cool little device that, if I remember right, was $35, and it looks like an old-school Game Boy. And it's called the Odroid Go Game Kit, and it looks really cool because it'll play all like the old handheld gaming systems. And I kind of want one, especially for the price. Okay, it's $36.95 and it's currently in stock on the link that I put in. And it'll do Game Boy, Game Boy Color, Game Gear, Nintendo Entertainment System, and Sega Master System. So it's not all of the old school handhelds, but it's all of the old Nintendo handhelds, plus the original NES and Sega Master System, which covers a lot.
That's awesome. Cool. I feel like I have to get one for of the price.
Yeah, and for the price, it looks like a great little kit, and you're putting it all together yourself, which is something I love. So I will probably get one in this upcoming year sometime and put it together and let you all know how it turned out, but it probably won't be in the next couple of months.
Cool. I'm curious to know.
Yeah, me too. But okay, and my other link that I have added was for a device that I found while I was helping out a friend to find a tablet that he could put Linux on. And of course, you know, he came to me because I love doing that. But we were looking at different devices because he had some very specific things that he wanted. And I found the Dell Venue Pro 7130. And it has me really excited. I mean, I haven't seen a device like this before. Basically, it has twice the power of the T102HA in the processor. Now, it's got the same amount of RAM. It's got the 4 gigs of RAM. But it's also got user-replaceable M.2 slots in the back. So, yeah, the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi that comes on it does not work with Linux because of proprietary drivers and all that. But you can put in your own M.2 Wi-Fi Bluetooth module, and it works perfect. And everything else works out of the box on this. I mean, the camera, the rotation, you don't have to do any of the coding that I had to do for the other devices to make the rotation work. It all just works out of the box after you put that card in. And the link I've included has the cards that will work on it, and they have like four or five listed that work, and how to install it, and how easy it is to install it. And it, the i3 version of this device on eBay used is running about $130 to $140, and the i5 version is running between $160 and $180. Maybe, I'm hoping sometime this year I'll be able to sell my other tablet devices and use that money towards getting this one. Because really, from the write-up alone, it looks to be the best tablet to run Linux on that I've seen so far.
Nice.
I can say that I've actually seen one of these up and running. Somebody comes to our lug, brought one a few months ago, and it's a lovely little bit of kit. Absolutely beautiful.
Now, you do have to be careful because you can't get the 7139 or the 7140, which do have slightly better processors and slightly better stats, because the 7140 evidently works like crap. But the 7130 is just perfect.
Very nice. And Tony Watts, you had some workspace switcher info for us.
Yeah, just a little tidbit, and I think you actually may have covered it in our last show, Leo, but it's just a link to it. We mentioned when we were kind of talking about the workplace switcher and using multiple desktops that some people are big fans of that and some people don't use it at all. But in any case, Linux Mint doesn't put the workplace switcher on the panel by default, but it's very, very easy to just add the workplace switcher as an applet to your panel so that you can use your, you know, four different desktops and switch back and forth between them. So if you're interested in doing that, it really is just right click and add applet. But I've linked in a forum that tells you how to do that.
Very cool. I did it right after I saw your article.
Yeah, sweet. And I think Bo and I just ignored it because we don't use it.
I don't use it either. I'm with you guys. I think I was just in Windows ecosystem too long, and I just use the one workspace. But you know, a lot of people really consider that a valuable productivity tool. So for those folks, that's a really easy change to make.
Yeah, Moss would speak to it. I know he uses it all the time. All right. And last little section on Check This Out is don't forget to upgrade to 19.1 if you feel so inclined. The quick and dirty of that is just make sure you have a backup, right? Backup all your important stuff before you do any upgrade. I think that's mostly just me worrying about upgrades, but back it up anyway. And if you just run your updates, there will be a little option under the edit menu in Update Manager, and it just says upgrade to Linux Mint 19.1 Tessa. Easy peasy, and it'll take you through the rest of the process. So get those upgrades going. And lastly, we have just one announcement, and that is typically our regular announcement, but there's a little bit extra here. So our next episode will be episode 300, and expect something a little bit different this time around. The ghost of Mintcast past. There's a hint for you. And that'll air at our normal time, 2 p.m. Central Time, on Sunday the 13th in January of next year. Cool, but before we leave, we want to make sure to acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. K-Wisher for the PiCaster, a Raspberry Pi that streams each episode as we record it. The folks over at Hacker Public Radio for the Mumble server we use to communicate. And, of course, the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about.
Thanks, Clem.
Thank you.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, everybody.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @mintcast and @linux_mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Mintcast.